And welcome back to Strong Style History's special overview of the matches that NJPW World are putting in, back up on the front page during these crisis times, some of which, of course, have new English commentary from Kevin Kelly. But, you know, again, since NJPW World doesn't have any content right now, any new content, then, hey, we can watch some good old matches. So, once again, I'm Jeffrey Wessel, and with me today is Chris Damasceno. Chris, how you doing?
Hey, doing all right. It's been quite some time since I've been in one of these history episodes. Looking forward to doing my best. I may not be Lawrence or Steve, but I try sometimes.
Yeah, Lawrence wasn't able to make it today, unfortunately, but, you know, things happen, and ironically, even though we're all on lockdown, supposed to be on lockdown, yeah, we still have a lot to do of things going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, we've been keeping busy. I mean, for you and I, we're working remotely. Lawrence is literally on the front lines, and God bless his soul for being part of that to begin with, because Jesus fuck, it's rough out here still, and we're still in a situation where it's probably going to get worse before it gets better, so just
Now we got these AstroTurf clowns who are...
Let's not even get onto that, because that's going to be like another 10-minute rant tangent for us. We both could be here like all night
just
trying to shit on these guys. Just in general, though, for all of the essential workers out there who are listening to this, thank you. You guys are awesome, and just hopefully keep at it. Stay as safe as you possibly humanly can, and we'll ideally get through this together at some point or another here, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Yeah,
that's about the best we can wish for at this point.
So in the meantime, once again, we're going to go through four older New Japan Pro Wrestling matches from cutting through a wide array of eras and ownerships and things like that. We're going to start off, we're going to do these chronologically again, so we're going to start off with a real doozy from August the 10th of 1989 from Tokyo Ryogoku Kokugikan, an IWGP heavyweight title match between Riki Choshu defending against Big Van Vader. Chris, take this away.
Yeah, Choshu did not give a single fuck within this one and definitely took it to Vader from the get-go here. And just what a time that was, because it's very interesting. Vader's mystique within New Japan Pro Wrestling has been something established from his very debut with the company when he just demolished Antonio Inoki, and that definitely played a hand here as Inoki was on commentary for this match, in fact. So you got to little bit of that
We got to the ring announcements, you see Vader stepping to the outside of the ring and just pointing directly at Inoki.
You definitely had some of those interactions there, but I like that Choshu just was not intimidated by any means, taking the fight to Vader when he could. Bombs were being thrown from both sides of the fence. Choshu was showing a little bit of his own power as well, too, slamming Vader around when he got the opportunities to do so.
That is what Riki means, so...
Yeah, indeed. I thought it was super interesting as well that at one point there, Vader actually went for the Sasori-Gatame as well, too, and kind of walked in for
it. Yeah, I got that in my nose, too. I was like, wow, that was kind of neat. that he pulled that. You wouldn't see a big guy like Vader usually doing a Sasori-Gatame.
Yeah, definitely not. Definitely a loud message sent shot across the bow, if you will. And then the finish, too, was the very interesting part for me. Because, again, Vader is one of those guys that we talk about athletic big men, but just in his prime, like, wow, just some of the stuff that he would pull out of seemingly nowhere. And in this finish, it kind of showed what if Sunset Flip Powerbomb, like a Sunset Flip cover of all things.
Yeah, how does Vader do a jump into a Sunset Flip? Vader, of all people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
My God. He was Leon White in his prime. My God.
Leon White in his prime is somebody that, if you had a time machine and you just wanted to drop him in like this era of like 2017 to now before the pandemic hit, like the amount of bangers that he would be having in just whether it's New Japan, whether it is Independence, shindies all over the place, just it would have been something to witness. Yeah, I know he kind of got a reputation as being like a grumpy old man near the end of his life there for a little while, but that was a guy that was money throughout like his prime and should be accounted as such.
And one of the very many talents that Vince McMahon completely misused.
Yep, 100%.
I mean, yeah, he got done. He was done wrong during his WWF wrong run, it must be said. But you know what? At the same time, that WWF run led to his All Japan run.
Yeah,
And
there was a silver lining at the end of the day, at
yeah, I
the
mean,
very least.
I know I'm one of the very few who really liked Vader's All Japan run in the late 90s, early 2000. But I still think that him and Kobashi in that Triple Crown match was a banger.
Yeah,
And I,
100%.
again, I know I'm in the minority on that, but you know what? I don't care. I love that match, and wrestling's all subjective anyway. So,
Quite true. It's why we talk about it in these podcasting things.
I mean, this was just two. It was just Choshu and Vader just laying bombs on each other the whole match, and Choshu just. I mean, it looked like Choshu could have had him at one point. And
And Vader
especially
just
like
outsmarted him, really. That was the surprising part of it. It wasn't like a big set of powerful moves that Vader used it to get it done. Like, he didn't overwhelm Choshu with power. He outsmarted him, which was really surprising for the ending of that
Choshu
match.
was the one who was like doing like top rope superplexes
Yeah,
to
exactly.
Vader's like, holy shit. But yeah, he gets done by a sunset flip of all things.
Indeed. And then,
And then, okay, so here's my question for you. So this is the first title change we have on this series that we're doing. This is the first
Yes.
match we've done that had a title change. Do you know who either of the two guys who were with Vader was?
No, I don't recall, unfortunately. Do you have that
Because
information, Jeff?
no, I don't. I tried to look, I couldn't find anything. One of them, I swear, looks like John Studd, but there's no way that was John Studd.
Yeah, it's just real. I'm kind of curious. Yeah, if you know this, just tweet us a Strong Style story without the Ian style. Like, we would like to know
We want to
personally.
know. Who were Vader's seconds in this match? Because I did not recognize either of them. Although, again, one of them looked like kind of like Big John Studd, but I don't think that there's no way that was him. I mean, I looked up, Studd's cage match, and I did not see him in New Japan in 1988, so or 89, excuse me. So yeah, I don't know. You got me on that, but the post match was really interesting too, with Vader stepping out with the trophy, which you don't really see anymore. The trophy that you get with winning the title, and he's calling out Inoki's starting to take his tie off and all that, but he walks in.
Inoki is pissed, to say the least.
Oh yeah, but
Like, he was not about to take that laying down by any means, and the crowd was right there with him for that. Like, they wanted to see those two just explode on the spot.
They were so wanting Vader and Inoki right then and there. But I looked it up. I don't think they ever actually had another match together for at least for that title. So, because his next couple of defenses, well, Inoki was the special referee for one of them. That out because I went off the page, unfortunately. So hang on a second.
You're fine, yeah, it is what it is.
But yeah, he was. His first title defense in '89 was his first title defense was against Bam Bam Bigelow, and Inoki was the special ref, and that was on October. That was on September the 20th at Osaka Joe Hall, and then the next day on the 21st of September, 1989. This was in at Yokohama Bunka Gym, and Vader defeated Shinya Hashimoto.
Yes. Yeah, he had a couple of defenses on that in which he had Bam Bam Hashimoto. He had a double count out with Stan Hansen, a DQ win over Hansen a couple of months later, and then Choshu beat him for the title again in August.
August the 19th in 1990. But yeah, he never actually faced Inoki again.
No. Interesting. Yeah. The special referee bout.
Yeah.
All right.
There were the next one that I could just see just eyeballing, it was a tag match at the 30th anniversary show. Actually Inoki's 30th anniversary, excuse me. And this was on September the 30th, 1990, in which Inoki and Tigerjeet Singh beat Animal Hamaguchi and Big Van Vader. Special referee, Nick Bockwinkel.
What a time.
But yeah, so they never had a singles match for the title. So it goes, I guess.
So it goes.
But, yeah, that was a fun match though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really fun, very quick.
Very quick. Just a wild finish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a very interesting dynamic going from those kinds of, you know, big time matches that New Japan would throw in, which you'd see your 10-15 minute marks, to where we're sort of seeing with current modern day New Japan, where they're taking more that King's Road approach to their main events with the 30-40 minute sort of like attempts at classics, which sometimes it works great, but sometimes those beginnings can be like really sluggish in terms of dragging around and stuff like that, which we've talked about in Strong Style Story many times before.
Yes, we have. So so with that in mind, let's move on to our second match of this retrospective. We're jumping ahead 2 decades.
Indeed.
We're actually almost at the end of we're like 9 days out from the ahead of the anniversary of this match. This was on April the 10th, 2010, at Tokyo Korakuen Hall. This was another IWGP heavyweight title defense. Shinsuke Nakamura, his first appearance in this retrospective, defending against the 2010 New Japan Cup winner Hirooki Goto. This was a good glimpse at a time when Goto was still considered worth something.
Yeah, mm-hmm, where there was still that, you know, that, but I guess what people would call that potential in him as one of the guys who could win the championship at a certain point and help the company. A couple of things that I thought were interesting is just given that this was I think was a year before the Bushiroad era really kicked off.
Nearly two.
Yeah, nearly a year two. Or two. Something like that. But the camera angles definitely gave that away in terms of how they were shooting Korakuen Hall at the time, to doing it from the opposite side of where we're used to seeing it nowadays, with the way they kind of arrange where the hard cam is, the way they did certain angles and such. So I thought that was a pretty big, interesting thing from that time. Obviously, Goto in shorts was something else. It took me a little while to remember that was a thing for him years ago.
Yeah, I mean, he this was back when he was still like kind of a young, you know, I wouldn't say plucky, but, you know, he was, you know, you know, one of the youngsters.
He was making that graduation from like plucky young lion to just establishing the full-esque samurai persona that we see him with nowadays. Shinsuke was interesting as well too, just with subconscious still being great, but still that full-fledged like MMA look, early Chaos days where Chaos were, you know, that combination of basically the remnants of GBH with Nakamura's whole perspective on, yeah, this shit isn't pure enough, we gotta take it back to the Inoki days kind of attitude that he had at the time.
Yeah, Nakamura wasn't quite there yet. I mean, he was not quite, you know, become in, you know, the Nakamura that we all know and love. His hair was a little questionable. He wasn't doing the full shtick with the, you know, no bending during the intro, no good vibrations, no yows, you know.
This was very much MMA-esque Nakamura, and really, sometime down the line, Jeff, I do think, like, at this point, it's been long enough to where a full episode on Shinsuke Nakamura's career could make for, like, an interesting history retrospective with a couple of matches being picked up, just because that
Yeah,
is
we
an
could.
incredibly interesting New Japan career that he had before leaving
Yeah.
for the States.
Well, interesting is a good word for it. Not necessarily all positive either.
Yeah, definitely. There was a lot of things, both good and questionable, with booking decisions and the like involving the guy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this was during Nakamura's third and final IWGP title reign. Of course, the first of which was highly questionable and maybe kind of ruined him a little bit for a good while.
It was very much, you can get into like again, I think it's something better tackled in like its own solo episode, but there's definitely a reason for, Shinsuke Nakamura being kind of as notable of a figure in New Japan lore as he is, both from the stuff that we grew to love out of him before him leaving the company and the stuff that came long before that. And this match is kind of a nice view mirror into the transition from that first era into the second era, in which I think became the one in which you became the most known to a lot of fans on the worldwide scale. But overall, decent match. I'd say just the beginning was a little bit wonky in terms of what they were doing with the grappling and such. But once you started having Shinsuke kind of play a little bit more of the control by, using the knees to just practically try to drill a hole through Goto's stomach,
Yeah.
like at the very least, that was one of the consistencies for Shinsuke. Like he had that sort of offense down pat from almost the get-go, and Goto eventually fighting back as well too was great. But much like you and Lawrence brought out in the previous episode itself too, I'll say it on my end as well too. Like even as someone who feels positively about English commentary compared to you guys, Kevin Kelly doing this solo just does not really work. I think that his formula, and I think the formula of English commentary in general, works best when it's Kelly bouncing off somebody like a Rocky Romero or a Gino Gambino for the color commentary side of the fence, and then having Chris Charlton there as like the third wheel and being the full-fledged like historian perspective, kind of like how WCW on its heyday used to do. You had Schiavone and Brain, and then you have like Mike Tenay in there for like the Cruiserweight matches, just giving that full-fledged like background on things, if that
Right.
makes any sense. So just that dynamic, I think, is missing from these. I think that it's a good starting point for a lot of the people who want to understand the history of the company a little bit better by viewing these, but I do think that they need to make that same kind of effort that they do with the live casts for the commentary on these past matches to kind of get it to match, I think.
Yeah, and it's like Kevin Kelly seems to think that there's something in suspense here, like, oh, well, will Goto overcome this time? Look, dude, we already know.
Yeah, it's one of those things like you either have to play full-fledged like you're, being drawn back to that time, or you have to give full contest. You can't mix between the two, which I felt Kevin Kelly was doing a lot of in the
Yeah.
this match, and then in this next match that we're going to talk after that as well.
Yeah.
So
Well, but let's not undersell the fact that, there was a period of time when Hirooki Goto pretty much owned the New Japan Cup.
yeah, that was in his prime in terms of that, so
Yeah, so he used to have credentials for, challenging for the IWGP heavyweight title. He hasn't had that challenge since, God, when was the last time he actually challenged for it? It was 16, wasn't it?
I believe so. Yeah. It would have been right. It would have been the
The
one
match with
match in which
Okada.
he painted himself. Yep. The paint in which he painted himself all white, got
Yeah.
kicked out entirely, and then joined Chaos.
Yeah, and
Hooray.
since the yeah. And so, and I know we tend to mock him, but I mean, you see matches like this, and it's like, God,
Yeah, there was something
he
there.
really could have been something, you know?
Yeah, I'll say this, like that near finishing sequence with the Bomae countered into the Yoshigarashi and then the GTR being countered into the across arm breaker from Shinsuke, which is then countered into like the hammerlock arm trap that Pentagon Jr. like famously does these days. Just like that was a sequence in and of itself. Their finish setup too was great.
Yeah, now that's what I had to bury Kevin Kelly for, because Goto was not using GTR in this time, because he didn't he didn't come up with that until that run against Okada.
Yeah, it was basically one of those situations where, again, Shoten Kai was kind of his main go-to at that time.
Yeah, and I kind of miss that move. I actually really still like Shoten Kai.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely still buy it as a finish more than anything. It's not that GTR is bad by any means, but and just the elevation that he gets on those and just the drop, like, it looks cool.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing about Shoten Kai is that Shoten Kai could have beaten Nakamura, but you notice that Goto pinned him like a, you know, very arrogantly, like he didn't hook the leg or nothing. So that was all him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a very, like, overconfident kind of cover rather than just, like, hooking the legs and holding on for dear life situation, which... Yeah. But... Yeah, the finish was really cool in terms of the knee counter from Nakamura and then eventually leading into the defining, like, Bomae that led to the cover. And then in the aftermath, we had the tensions that at the time were playing of, you know, Nakamura and Yano basically being the one that caused the entirety of GBH to defer over to now Chaos and Makabe just not giving a single solitary fuck and wanting Nakamura's ass for it, which he would get 2 months from that point and win the title, in fact. So
yes, he would. So yeah,
there's a bit of history.
And thus would end Nakamura's third and final IWGP heavyweight title reign.
Yeah, and in a way it would lead to kind of the end of that first era of Shinsuke Nakamura and leading to the second one, which is the more well-known one for a lot of people out there. So
yeah, that much is true, actually. So maybe we can table that for another for an coming episode.
Yeah.
Once we start resuming regular episodes of Strong Style History,
but
we're doing these special ones. So should we just transit? And speaking of Togi Makabe, that transitions nicely into our third match today.
Yeah, good choice of the match selection order, Jeff, because this transitions into it super well.
From March 6th of 2011, the 39th anniversary of New Japan Pro Wrestling. This is from Tokyo Korakuen Hall, and this is also the final first round matchup of that year's New Japan Cup, which We get told numerous times from Kevin Kelly that, yes, Nakamura beat Goto in the first round earlier in this show, so he would not be winning the New Japan Cup that year.
Yep, so you got that bit of dominance out of the way there, but camera angles, more traditional now, so you're starting to see that Bushiroad influence coming through.
Although I still think this was the Yuke's. I think this is like the last year of Yuke's.
The last year of Yuke's, because the transition would have been that year, but in the fall, right, around the time that they did King of Pro Wrestling. Okay, that makes
sense. No, they didn't even do King of Pro Wrestling that year. That was 2012.
It would have been the year later. Okay,
yeah, which we covered. Which I had my timeline. Which we covered on an earlier episode of Strong Style History.
Yeah, for some reason I was thinking 2011 instead of 2012. So now that's on me.
Yeah, because Wrestle Kingdom 6 was the first Bushiroad Wrestle Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
So gotcha. That would have been after this year. But with that in mind, we have Togi Makabe taking on not only the just recently dethroned IWGP heavyweight champion but also the leader of what was then known as Kojima-gun.
Indeed. And a very younger, wild-haired, far more face-punchable Taichi right alongside him as the Kojima gun wrap there, as it was.
Kojima making his third appearance on this show. Taichi, rather, making his third appearance on this show. Also making an appearance, did you see who was on Young Lion duty in this match?
I do believe we saw good old Hiromu Takahashi in there at some point.
We also saw Bad Luck Fale.
Indeed, when he was still just Young Lion long before the Blue Army days, and then obviously long before Bullet Club was a thing. So, yeah, some interesting faces there that popped up. Of course, even in these archive footages, Makabe's entrance would just have to be censored and silenced entirely, because even for a cover of Foreigner's song and a Led Zeppelin cover, New Japan's not willing to pay the bucks for it. And you know what? I don't blame them for it.
Yeah. Led Zeppelin notorious for not wanting to license their music. So,
yep. Big nope. Gigantic nope.
Yeah.
So, no, thank you. But,
well, you know that. But, you know that didn't used to be an issue though in the days before NJPW world. Now it's an issue. So.
Yeah, I mean, look, nobody's safe. Not even as discussed at many times during Strong Style Story. Not even Chris Jericho, with his own song by his own band, was safe from copyright law in Japan, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this theme. I mean, you notice what the theme for this show is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yep. It's the old, you know, Emerson, Lake, and Powell, you know, song that New Japan used to use as their intro, but of course they can't use that now.
Nope.
So yeah, we're copyright.
Copyright law is a bitch.
The law is an ass. Yes. So anyway, yes, we're here in the days of Kojima-gun, mere months before one Minoru Suzuki would show up and steal. Steal Kojima's unit from him.
Yeah, New Japan with the history here of guys stealing units from other people. I mean, we just talked about the formation of Chaos coming off of Sublime Master Thief Toru Yano and Shinsuke Nakamura stealing GBH basically right from under Togi Makabe. Or Makabe, excuse me, outside of Tomaki Homa, who stuck around with him. But, I mean, everyone else went away at that point. And you know, Kojima-gun turning into Suzuki-gun not much later from this point. So,
anyway, what did you think of this match?
I thought it was interesting in the fact that Kojima played a really good sneaky heel. Using Taichi as a distraction will always help you in that regard, but Kojima leaning into it heavy was a very nice touch. And it's also good as well that he stayed in that role for a while, because for a while there, as we remember, he left New Japan to begin with, went to All Japan, came back universally hated and with good reason. So it made for a really good dynamic between the guy who left and came back trying to take things over to
Don't forget, even when he was in All Japan for a little bit there, he was part of Voodoo Murders.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There was that, and then with Makabe being a homegrown guy, you know, the crowd definitely had a clear I would say plucky babyface, but let's face it, Makabe is not plucky nor babyface. It's enough, no matter how hard he tries. This is the guy who literally flip off the crowd and get like unironically cheered for it just because.
Yeah, but you notice that this is also a time period of time when Togi Makabe was considered a top guy.
Yeah, 100%. And the guy definitely had a charisma to him as well, too. Crowds dug him completely, and I know, like, for a lot of the fans who may have currently come into the fold over the last, like, 2 or 3 years, they may not quite understand why he's as popular as he is, but, like, back in the days in which he was far more mobile, he could go in terms of the wrestling matches, and, yeah, he's a guy who likes the sweets, runs a really good blog about it, and is on TV a lot, so good for him in that regard.
But, you know, I have to say, though, Kojima definitely in my top 25 of all time. Yeah, my own personal top 25. I've loved him ever since he was part of the NWO. Of course, he Tenkoji is one of the best tag teams of all time. And then, of course, you know, he jumped to shockingly jumped to All Japan when Muto and Kendo Kashin, of all people, jumped ship, because Muto had finally had it with the Inokiism shit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. during a time in which All Japan wasn't all that hot to begin with, where Noah was kind of the new hot kid in town at the time too. So
and with good reason.
Definitely.
And with good reason. 100%
with good reason. But yeah, it made for some interesting things. And Kojima is low key one of those guys that could go in just about any situation there during his prime, and he showed a lot of that here as well, kind of matching Maccabi's intensity, bit by bit there. A lot of close falls with, your lariats, suplexes, and the like. Makabe's spider suplex, when he could do it in his day, was like super impressive
It
outright.
was.
Like, still think a beauty to watch. And just, yeah, I felt it was a really good job. Makabe took a really nasty chair shot there at a certain point, too, to point that
Yeah,
out.
that
Like, that
was
was an oof moment there.
Hey, while we're talking about Kojima, do you remember Kojima's debut match in All Japan?
No, you may have to refresh my memory on
I
that one.
don't remember the date offhand. I know it was in February of 2002. It was against Genichiro
Goodness.
Tenryu.
Talk
Welcome to
about
All
some history
Japan.
there. Yeah. Talk
And
about
then
some history
that,
there, especially considering Tenryu's history with that company as well, too.
yeah. Well,
So
that was also yeah. That was the same show that Muto would actually drop his first Triple Crown reign against. He dropped it to Kawada.
Yeah, so just
In Muto's first match as an All Japan employee, he dropped the title.
I mean, hey, he was taking over the book and everything else too. Like,
Well,
he
no,
was doing business.
that
Get
was a
him
year. That was
a
about a
year
year
later?
later. Yeah, that was about a year later. And by the way, at some point, if we ever, I've always promised that if we ever get to actual episode 25, or maybe even 20, I may shorten it to 20 of Strong Style History. Keiji Muto's 2001 is going to be the topic because that is a topic very near and dear to my heart. So.
I'm good to do it if you are. So I'll watch the matches you recommend, and we'll get at it.
Yeah,
That's good content for
if
the
we could
network.
find them all, because
Yeah,
some of
for
them may not
sure.
be available. But anyway, in the end, Makabe overcomes Kojima. Honestly, I thought the match was kind of standard. There wasn't
Yeah, I mean.
anything. There wasn't anything really, special in the match. It was kind of standard. We also have tied for appearances on during this retrospective. Hiroshi Tanahashi makes
Yep,
his
because
third
he.
appearance. During this, because he came in and made the save against, he beat the shit out of Taichi, so that Makabe could win against Kojima.
Yeah, for sure. A fun bit there with running, playing into the Kojima-gun situation. Of course, Hiroshi Tanahashi and Satoshi Kojima had their share of history at that time, too. So,
Well,
extra motivation there.
WrestleKingdom
Yeah,
mere months
exactly.
previous.
Yep. Exactly. So there was definitely that. And I think for the match itself, as you mentioned, it was a standard fare, but I think the crowd being as hot as they were for Makabe making his comeback and eventually pulling out the win on this one gave it a little bit of an extra edge to me to where I'm like, yeah, super enjoyed it. So.
So let's go into our final match of this episode. We jump to February the 3rd, 2013, also at Tokyo Korakuen Hall. I feel kind of bad that all the like three quarters of the like all the matches have been in Tokyo, and three quarters of them were at Korakuen Hall this time.
Yeah, I mean,
I feel kind of bad
hey,
about that.
yeah, it's sort of a situation where, yeah, it's got a little bit of a. But then again, Korakuen Hall and Japanese pro wrestling are kind of the peanut butter and jelly sort of combination
Well,
for
that's true,
majority of the world, so yeah.
but also consider that we're also covering some matches during a time period where New Japan was not quite
Exactly, they
where they
were
are
not.
today.
Yeah, exactly. And even in this era, this was the part in which they were starting that recovery process, as a matter of fact. At this point, under Bushiroad, under the Bushiroad era, if you will, at the beginnings of it. So,
By then we were out of the dark period. They came through it, and now we're I would say Wrestle Kingdom 6 was the beginning of the revitalization, and here we are a year later, February the 3rd, 2013. I think this was during, if not the actual New Beginning show, but the tour of the New Beginning. This was a never open weight title defense. Masato Tanaka, Dangan, going up against Tomohiro Ishii, and holy Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and by the way, yeah, this was the Road to the New Beginning, one of the Road to the New Beginning shows
Okay.
during that time frame. So, as a guide to that, but just boy, because altogether, that just if you want a kind of a glimpse of the window in which these never open weight title matches would go into, and I know a lot of people will say that Tomohiro Ishii's rise within the company began during his performances at the G1 Climax that same year, G1 Climax 23. But the match that got him into that tournament to begin with, this was the match, as a matter of fact,
Oh
because
golly.
boy.
We talk about Choshu and Vader throwing bombs at the beginning, in the first match on this. This was outright nuclear warfare between
Yeah,
these two. Holy
100%.
shit.
When you were like within the first few minutes of the match, making regular audiences kind of these days, especially with what we know about CTE, completely uncomfortable with dueling unprotected headbutts as a
Yes.
standoff spot.
Yes. Yeah,
Ugh.
and there were a few of those spots too.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean,
Oh,
keeping in mind
100%.
who was the defending NEVER champion during this time was Masato Tanaka. This is a guy, yeah, unprotected chair shots to the head were de rigueur for him because,
Yeah.
of course, he was a veteran of FMW, ECW.
ECW.
You know.
And the thing is, even to this day, Masato Tanaka is still one of the most consistent performers out there in the game right now,
Oh
which
yeah,
is
in 0-1 mostly
astounding.
nowadays.
Yeah, which is astounding considering the not only just the amount of miles he's put on his body, but the types of matches that he has done in the process of it.
Oh my
Just.
goodness. Well, before we go too much further, did you catch who was on commentary in this match?
Dang it, I'm trying to recall. Was Liger amongst one of them? I'm trying to
Nope. It
think.
was one Mr. Tetsuya Naito.
Okay, so it was Naito. Then again, that makes sense because Naito and Tanaka interacted for the never, or would interact at some point for the never open weight
That's
title
correct,
portion
yeah.
as well. So, yeah.
So, and Naito had a very interesting 2013. But
Oh, God.
we'll talk about that another time.
Boy.
So Ishii gets bust open a third of the way into the match, and that just pretty much sets the stage for what's to come.
Yep, we got color, folks. But again, if there was a match that just shows the blueprint of what I think makes really good Tomohiro Ishii matches, just from a fundamental standpoint, where he's fighting from underneath as an underdog and then eventually overcoming, that's where I think he's at his best. And we've seen that formula plenty of times over the past couple of years at this point, and it works every single time for the most part. So it's
Yeah,
like,
keeping in mind that prior to this match, Ishii was usually like the fall guy in Chaos.
yeah. And he was a junior heavyweight for a while there too before making that transition into, the open weight slash,
The
heavyweight
big
style that he's done
beefy.
now.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And
He was a
now.
small beefy boy rather than just now a beefy boy.
Yeah, he. Yeah, and, Tanaka was just. He was going with him. I mean, there was no carrying being done in this match, but Tanaka just matched him. I mean, and let's again, he's a wily old veteran. I mean, not that Ishii was a young gun by this point either, but I mean, having been around the block a few times.
Pecking order basically is what played a hand into the dynamics of this match, and it worked out really well for it.
Yeah, but again, I mean, we're talking about Tanaka again. A veteran of FMW and ECW. Yeah, he's taken some hits, of a few varieties.
Quite.
I mean, you can still see the. I mean, even that, you can still see the scars he had on him.
Yep.
Sure, a couple of exploding barbed wire matches were in his.
Yeah, a couple of gushers here and there doing the trick on that one.
Yeah.
So,
But do you think that this match may have been the beginning of what the stereotypical NEVER style became? Because let's not forget that the NEVER belt was supposed to be the belt that the youngsters were supposed to be going for.
yeah, definitely. I think this was the blueprint for it right there. I think the fact that it coincides with Tomohiro Ishii's rise in the company as well, too, that there was that common thread between the two, for sure, and kind of the reason why Ishii would become such a staple of that division to begin with. Whether the company was expecting something like that to hit the way that it did, to where it would influence an entire title picture for the next, 5 to 7 years. I don't think they knew that at the time, but they hit on something with this match, and it became the blueprint for
Well,
what
and
we would eventually see.
unfortunately, the di part of the dividends you could see from the blueprint of the style would, cost the career of Katsuyori Shibata.
Yeah, that's. And again, it's just with the hindsight in mind, I'm like, oh yeah, months later was when that match happened. Oh boy.
Well, years later.
No. Months later was when that match between Ishii and Shibata at the G1 happened, where
Oh,
that whole
right.
style and the rises of both guys, I think, for an international audience's perspective, like where their stocks just went, whoop, let's go,
Yeah.
kind of thing. So.
But yeah, this but yeah, this was just this was just a great match. I mean, just two guys just beating the shit out of each other, and it was glorious. Tanaka eventually wins with a sliding lariat.
Yep.
And oh my God, and respect was shown post match because yeah, you gotta show respect after a match like that.
And I'm trying to remember, wasn't Tanaka also a part of Chaos at the time, or was he freelance just outright?
I think he was part of Chaos because I know that Nakamura was out as a second for Ishii. I think he was
Okay,
just
yeah.
kind of there. I think he was just kind of whatever at that
He was
point.
just kind of like at best like a freelance Chaos guy, which yeah, it would have worked for the camaraderie they showed at the end there, so cool.
Kazushi Sakuraba would end up being,
Yes. Yep.
So, but yeah, this was a fantastic contest, and this was yeah. I mean, go out of your way to watch this one. It's something worth seeing.
Yeah, a very good match to wrap things up on, even if the headbutts make me a little queasy at this juncture of my life. But
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
that just the overall intensity of the match and just the way that Ishii kind of gained that connection with the crowd, really, as of this match, that would carry him forward into some really good performances later during the course of the year that kind of made him into the main stalwart that we see him being these days. 2013, yeah, was the year of Tomohiro Ishii finally kind of establishing himself as something more than just a fall guy for a stable. Unfortunately, Yoshihashi would take that mantle and carry it all the way through the rest of the 2010s and probably into the 2020s, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, we're not here to talk about Yoshihashi right now. So, with that in mind, I'm actually gonna list. We already have the four matches we're gonna do next time. Hopefully, this coming weekend.
Yes.
We already have the four matches picked up for this. I'm actually gonna do it in reverse chronological order. Even though when we record, we're gonna do them in chronological order. But because this will be another nice segue because the first and therefore fourth match we're going to cover will be August the 2nd, 2013, from night two of G1 Climax 23 at Korakuen Hall. We're going to do Hiroshi Tanahashi versus Tomohiro
Cannot wait.
Ishii. Also on the also next episode, again, reverse chronological order. Yuji Nagata versus Yoshihiro Takayama, IWGP Heavyweight
Yeah.
Title match, May 2nd, 2002, from the Tokyo Dome. Not to be outdone, another earlier IWGP Heavyweight Title match, December 10th, 1994, from Osaka Prefectural Gym. Back before it was Bodymaker Coliseum, and back before it was the Edion Arena, it was just the Osaka Prefectural Gym, and this was Shinya Hashimoto defending against Hiroshi Hase.
I'm excited for that one,
Oh
man.
yeah.
Like, we need some more Hase, and they've shown this is a really good way of doing it.
And then our last and then therefore our first match next episode. Strap in for this one from May 1st, 1986 from Tokyo Ryugoku Kokugikan, Tatsumi Fujinami versus Akira Maeda.
There we go. My God. What a
So
time.
So hopefully we're going to get that out to you next week. But in the meantime, hope you enjoyed us going over this retrospective. Again, all these matches are on the front page of NJPW World. And when I say the front page, I mean you may have to scroll a little bit, but they have been posted, you know, freely to NJPW World. You still need a subscription for some of them. But, you know, and again, they're a lot of these, they're adding English commentary to these for the first time. But, you know, just something to do while you're craving the graps. Just, head on over to NJPW World, watch some classic New Japan. So, and I just want you to know that I did sacrifice a Keiji Muto match for Tanahashi Ishii. So, episode four, there may be some Keiji Muto happening.
Yes, exactly. By that, it just means we've given Jeff the leeway to at least put two Muto matches in episode four, if not more. This is fine. This is all fine. Sacrifices must be made.
Indeed, indeed. So, Chris, you want to plug yourself real quick?
All right, you can go over to Brazilian Fury. That's with Brazilian with an S instead of a Z on Twitter or Instagram, and just follow me there. Fairly simplistic. My other podcast, Soundtracks on the Sticks, that's at Sounds on Sticks on Twitter, and we're part of the Night of the Living Geeks network there, soundcloud.com/DNOTLG.
And, of course, you know, our other podcast will be coming to you directly on Wednesday night with Boom Goes the Dynamite, because AEW still insists on showing episodes of Dynamite during this time, which, in fairness, they've been pre-taped, but we kind of went on a rant about that last episode, so we're not going to relitigate that here.
Yep.
But, so either we'll see you on Wednesday for Boom Goes the Dynamite, or we'll see you hopefully next weekend with the third in our retrospective on the uploads for NJPW World. So until then, stay safe, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.